If you felt stuck trying to lose weight, you're not alone. Enter Weight Loss by Hers. It's designed to support you in reaching your goals. And Hers now offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first GLP-1 available in a pill, so there are no needles needed. Everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door, no insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Weight Loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget, if eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/women to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/women. forhers.com/women. Weight loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com.
I actually had 4 arrests during my drug career. I got arrested in a pretty movie-like SWAT team arrest in my apartment in Los Angeles. I had a front of what I was doing. I had a recording studio and I kind of pretended I was making music for my living and DJing. But really, my recording studio was the place I sold drugs out of.
Were people enabling you? What was going on with the people around you?
Yeah, great question. It's funny. That's the first time anybody's asked me on the podcast about this. I was in a motorcycle accident, but I was also carrying about 0.5 pound of cocaine on me in my pocket. There's a sense by now that the police were actually already following me because the first 2 cops on the scene were unmarked police officers. So I was facing 13 to 18 years. Got kicked out of my first rehab. I had a really confrontational call with my dad. This time, as he was yelling at me, he finished it off with a question. What do you expect us to do now? And I said, you know what? You can't do anything. I have to fix this myself.
You ended up getting your PhD.
But Rachel, when I got out of jail, I had 9 felonies on my record. I couldn't get a job. Nobody will hire me. And I went back to school. Fate, serendipity, call what you want. But the advice they matched me up with was doing research with injection drug users who were homeless. When you find your purpose, I found it with that advisor. All the things that seemed to bother you before in life, they just kind of become part of the regular everyday experience you have in order to serve your purpose.
Welcome back to Misunderstood. I'm your host, Rachel Yucatel. Today, we have a truly powerful guest, someone who knows firsthand what it means to be misunderstood. Dr. Adi Jaffe is a behavioral neuroscientist, addiction expert, and author who has dedicated his life to changing the conversation around addiction and mental health. But before he became a respected thought leader in the space, he struggled for much of his own life as an addict until he hit rock bottom. Dr. Jaffe's journey from battling addiction and facing the consequences of his past to earning a PhD in psychology from UCLA has shaped his unique and deeply personal approach to recovery. He's not afraid to challenge the traditional models of addiction treatment, calling out the flaws of the rigid abstinence-based system and offering an alternative, one that actually meets people where they are without shame or stigma. His work has been featured everywhere from CNN to the Huffington Post, and he's become a sought-after voice in the conversation about redefining addiction and mental health. Now he's back with his latest book, Unhooked, Free Yourself from Addiction Forever, where he introduces the Unhooked Method, a step-by-step program designed to help people identify what's really driving their addictions and break free from the cycles that hold them back. It's a revolutionary approach that flips the script on everything we think we know about addiction and self-sabotage. Dr. Jaffe joins me today to talk about his own story, why so many of us have addiction all wrong, and how Unhooked offers a new way forward for anyone looking to regain control of their life. I can't wait for you to hear this conversation, so let's go.
Misunderstood.
Dr. Jaffe, thank you so much for joining us today on Misunderstood. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for having me on, Rachel.
I'm really excited that you're here. Your story of overcoming addiction is really powerful. Can you tell our listeners and our watchers about that and kind of how you got to where you are?
Sure. Yeah, I was probably that stereotypical kid in high school who, got introduced to alcohol. I talk about in the book, really innocuous way of being introduced, right? I was a socially anxious kid, somebody I knew but didn't know well, handed me a bottle of vodka, and I wanted to look cool. I didn't want to look awkward in front of these new friends. Took a couple of swigs, and it was really disgusting. I mean, it was really, really disgusting, warm vodka. But within 20, 25, 30 minutes, all my anxiety went away. Mm. And what I talk about in my book is, for the first time, I could talk to girls and not be nervous. I could feel like one of the guys. And so that, at the age of 14, started this path for me of really recognizing, I would say, that there are things outside of myself that could ease my pain, ease my suffering. Unfortunately for me, that led to more and more drugs. I just kept looking for more and more things to fix what was wrong inside. Led to cocaine, led to heavy duty use of other drugs, and eventually methamphetamine found me. And I always say that's the drug that really, really got me. I moved from using it for school and for studying every few months to using it every week to using it every day. I started selling drugs because I was using so much that I really couldn't afford to use them without making money off of them. And the book actually opens up with what closed that chapter in my life. But after about 6-7 years of essentially being a drug dealer and a heavy duty daily drug user, I got arrested in a pretty movie-like NCIS kind of SWAT team arrest in my apartment in Los Angeles. And that was a really pivotal moment where everything changed for me.
How old were you when that happened?
I was 26.
So let me ask you a question. Leading up to being 26 years old and having such a big addiction that seemed obvious, who was in your life? Were your parents, did they know what was going on? Were people enabling you? Were people having strict boundaries with you? And what was going on with the people around you?
Yeah, great question. It's funny. That's the first time anybody's asked me on the podcast about this. I grew up in Israel, and there's this joke I'll say. It's I was 14 years old. We moved from Israel. That's when that camp happened. We had moved to Chicago. And in Israel, when you're a kid, there are almost no rules. And this has fallen off to some extent now as, digital media has picked up, et cetera. But there's a reality in Israel, all the kids go to the army, right? So after high school, you go to the military. And the parent line in Israel is, you can act out now, they'll fix you in the army. Oh. And because we moved at the age of 14, my parents never knew how to set boundaries. And then I never got the army on the backside. I always say the jail was my army service because, no matter what you do in the military, you've got to fall in line or they'll put you in jail. So I never had that. I had no boundaries. By the time my parents really tried to put boundaries on, I was 16, 17 years old, and it was too late. I was already pretty heavy into drug use. So really great question.
Right. Okay. And by the time you got arrested, what was your life? Were you working? Like, tell me how you were functioning, if at all.
Yeah. So my parents lived in New York by the time I started even dealing when I moved to Los Angeles. I moved myself out to LA because coming from Israel, I was used to sun and sea and desert. And then my parents moved us to Chicago and upstate New York, which was, going from Israel to Buffalo is pretty much the biggest change other than like Alaska or something that you could go through in life. I hated the cold, moved myself out to LA, and I was going to school at UCLA, but very quickly. And I mean by that very, very quickly, things started falling off. I was far away from my parents. And so far, they really, they could come visit once or twice a year. We didn't have a ton of money either. And so I was functional in terms of going to school, but I graduated by the skin of my teeth. I barely made it out of UCLA as an undergrad. I started selling drugs pretty substantially by the time I was in my senior year of college. I'll say it like this. I had a front of what I was doing. I had a recording studio and I kind of pretended I was making music for my living and DJing. But really, my recording studio was the place I sold drugs out of. So to anybody who didn't know me, on the outside, it looked like I was making okay money. But Rachel, I was 124 pounds when I got arrested. I'm 165 right now. So imagine this with 40 pounds less. I was a skeleton.
Wow. And what were your aspirations at the time? How did you think your life was going to turn out?
You know, I don't think I had aspirations, Rachel. I think I was looking one foot in front of the other, just making it to tomorrow. The only goal I really had, even when I started selling the drugs, was to get out from under my parents' control in terms of money. And from that viewpoint, drug dealing actually worked really well. I joke that it's only the last few years I started making more money legally than I made selling drugs. It's a very lucrative place to live, but an incredibly uncomfortable one. You're stressed 24 hours a day. You're watching out for the police. I actually had 4 arrests during my drug career. It's only the last one that was so serious that it really made me rethink my life wholesale.
All right. So let's talk about that for a minute. You were arrested, and tell people about that event a little bit and the jail stint. What happened there?
Yeah. So the way it started, I was in a motorcycle accident. This is actually not in the book, but it's in one of my TED Talks. I was in a motorcycle accident, but I was also carrying about 0.5 pound of cocaine on me in my pocket. I was out making deliveries. And I got in a motorcycle accident and broke my leg. Mm. There's a sense by now that the police were actually already following me because the first 2 cops on the scene were unmarked police officers, kind of undercover. But regardless, one way or another, as I was going up into the ambulance, they took my jacket off of me, found the drugs inside, and I was actually arrested in the hospital. They followed me to the hospital. My leg was pretty badly broken, so I wasn't a flight risk because I literally couldn't walk. Mm-hmm. So they kept just coming back over and over and over, trying to get, you know, with 0.5 pound of cocaine, they knew I knew some dealers. They wanted me to kind of snitch. They wanted me to talk about who was above me. I wasn't about to do that. And so after about 3 months, they got sick and tired of asking me questions and playing nice. And the Beverly Hills PD came to arrest me in my apartment. That's, again, how the book opens. Mm-hmm. I went to jail right away. I was still actively using at the time. So I say I detoxed in jail. And it was 5 days of a pretty terrible experience. They put me in the hospital wing. So people with broken limbs, missing limbs, people who had been shot. I mean, it was pretty bad. But all I did was sleep and eat. I had a high bail because I had a gun on me and a bunch of other things when I got arrested. So my bail was set at almost $1 million. About 5 days later, I went to see the judge and got released. My bail got lowered substantially. I had a lawyer by that point. But really, I was facing, after that arrest, I was facing 13 to 18 years. About was the range that I was looking at. I went to rehab first, got kicked out of my first rehab. And this is actually a story that's not in the book, but it was in the middle between that rehab and the first rehab and the second that I had a really confrontational call with my dad. My dad was amazing. He's passed since, but he was amazing. And he called me every day to check in. Every single day he called and checked in. So he called the day that I got kicked out of that first rehab for using. I used for 2 months in that rehab. And he called.
Wait, time out. How does that happen?
I did a good month. My first month, I was pretty sober. And then they let me go to work. But I was so good at lying to everybody. My work was going to my recording studio. And so within a week, Rachel, I was back to using. And
they don't drug test you when you come back to the rehab?
They drug tested me about 2 months later when it became very obvious that I couldn't hide it anymore.
Right.
And so immediately the morning that the test came back, they kicked me out. Told me if I could get 30 days sober by myself, then I'm welcome back in. But obviously I was having a pretty hard time getting a few days even at that point. Right. And so my dad called. I had this whole set of lies set up for him, like I always did, about what I'd done. And, I was saying the rehab's too far from my studio. I need to move somewhere closer. And there was this pit. I can almost feel it now as I'm talking about it, the pit in my stomach. As I kept lying, saying, you know what, just own your truth. Just tell him what actually happened. Just take a hard right now and get back on track. Eventually I did that in the middle of that conversation. And my dad, who never really did this before, but he started screaming at me because he was at a loss. You know, they had just spent money for 3 months on rehab. Mm-hmm. And here I was throwing everything away, looking at 15, 13, 18 years in prison. But this time, as he was yelling at me, he finished it off with a question. Normally they would try to fix it for me. You know what I mean, Rachel? They would line up the next rehab. They would tell me, hold on, we'll do this, that, and the other thing, and kind of move mountains for me. Mm-hmm. In this situation, my dad kind of put his arms up. This is pre FaceTime call. So I don't know if he was really putting his arms up, but he essentially said, what do you expect us to do now? And it was the first moment, Rachel, that I had to think about the answer. And I said, you know what? You can't do anything. I have to fix this myself.
Wow.
And that was a real come to Jesus moment for me. I couldn't get sober right away, but I looked for a treatment center every day. I found one that was much cheaper than what they were spending on before. I didn't really like spending a lot of money of my parents' money for rehab. Stayed sober in this next one for 8 months. And then I, my sentencing came for my court case, and I ended up serving a year in jail, in LA County jail.
Wow.
And you asked what that was like.
Yeah.
I joke that jail is the only place you can be scared out of your mind and bored at the exact same time.
Wow.
It sucked. I mean, it's everything you see, you know, from the strip searches when you walk in to the inhumane a la. I remember saying this to my wife when I first met her, and we were talking about how bad it was. One of the worst things that happens in jail, and a lot of us never think about these kinds of things, but, you know, you have to go to the bathroom on a regular basis. Imagine having to do that in front of a whole room full of people, some of whom may just be reading a magazine, brushing their teeth, showering, and, you know, you're out there exposed. It's
right.
Little things like that that just dehumanize you as a person.
Mm.
And so I had a year of that. And, and you know, there were a lot of experiences in there. I'll just say when I left, I had a number one priority, and that was how to make sure I didn't go back there for the rest of my life.
Right. So was that the first time that you had that amount of long time that you had been off drugs in, you know, a decade before?
Yeah, probably since the age of 15. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So since you've gotten out of prison, how have you been doing with your recovery?
So the first year was really, really hard. It's actually, you know, I talked to you before. I run a company now that helps people who are coming out of jail and prison with mm-hmm. services. We literally now contract with the Departments of Corrections. You know, it's crazy to think about, but they give you like a bus ticket.
I know.
And then tell you to get out. That's all you really get.
It's setting people up for such failure. It's so upsetting to the people that do want to take the opportunity and have a better life or start over. I mean, it is so difficult for them. And then forget whether or not they have an underlying addiction. I mean, I kind of forgot about that, but just to get off their feet, to get over the stigma of that they've been in prison, that they probably don't have a lot of money. They probably don't have a lot of support, and they end up going back to what they did before. And the recidivism rate is so, you know, high or whatever. And it's insane to me. And then if you have an addiction, I just can't imagine. It's got to be so hard.
Addiction, mental health issues,
right.
Problematic environmental influences. So I'll tell you this, Rachel, right? Like, it was in rehab, I got a new phone number, because people would literally call me in rehab seeing when I'm getting out of rehab so I can set them up with drugs again.
Oh God!
I was incredibly lucky that I had a family that supported me. But Rachel, when I got out of jail, I had 9 felonies on my record. I couldn't get a job at the mall. I couldn't get a job bagging groceries. I tried to get a job as a pizza delivery boy, and I got rejected. I mean, nobody would hire me. So my family had to support me, pay rent, pay for my food for 9 straight months. It was after those 9 months that I said, you know what? I've got to find another route. I'm banging my head against the wall. Nobody will hire me. And I went back to school.
Mm.
You know, we're talking about this now, what is it, 14 years later, and serendipity just so had it that going to school was a really, really incredible choice for me.
Right.
But I didn't go back to school because I thought I was going to get a PhD. I went back to school because they didn't ask, have you ever been convicted of a felony? And I knew I could get in. And
right.
I thought it would just buy me some time.
Oh my God. Wow. Yeah, exactly. So what did you just go in with a general plan or with no plan? And then all of a sudden your calling was like, oh, wait, I can help people.
I would say literally the only plan at the time, and I tell this to my clients now, figure out what the next goal is and do everything you can to get there, because you don't know what is available once you reach that next step.
Right.
So I went to Cal State Long Beach. I actually called UCLA, which is where I got my bachelor's, to see if I could apply to graduate school. And essentially they said to me, don't waste the application money. You're not getting in. I had like a 2.7 GPA. Oh. I wasn't a great student. And again, it's really funny. The story ended up working out where I went to Cal State Long Beach. And again, fate, serendipity, call it what you want. But the advisor they matched me up with was doing research with injection drug users who were homeless. And so I was meeting every day and doing interviews with people who were homeless users of drugs. And we were studying hepatitis C and HIV. But
wow,
I found out that I really connect with them.
Yeah.
Now, I might come from an upper middle class family, but, you know, because of my experience, Rachel, I was dealing with the gutter of LA, I'll call it, right? Mm-hmm. I've done the, you know, the Lincoln Navigator cartel deals for, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars. And I've also sold on the streets of LA. So it's like, there was no judgment left in me. And so I found that I could really relate to the people I was talking to. And I really liked the work. Right. And, you know, you asked
Can I just ask you a quick question? Sorry. About relating to them. Was it that you found that the underlying feelings they had were similar, or the reasons that they were down and out, or the reasons why they were misunderstood or doing these drugs? Like, was that what you had empathy about?
Well, it started with one thing. I wasn't embarrassed about the conversation. You know, a lot of times talking to somebody who's really struggled and doesn't come from the same, I'll say, path of you that you experience creates a lot of judgments in our heads. And we start seeing the person as a label and not really who they are. Well, I'd been there. So it didn't matter that I was in a master's program. Now I could see them and talk to them about what they were really going through. And so people would feel more authentic and they felt like they could be more honest with me and they wouldn't need to hide things. And then I wouldn't shame them. We asked really, really private questions in these surveys that we were doing. And I could just connect to them. It's almost like it didn't matter what answer you gave me. That was for this research. I'm still going to understand you as a person. And that's something I try to do to this day, because I know how bad it can be. You know, my dad was a physician. I still ended up being a meth dealer in Los Angeles. So, so that was one thing. I could understand and not shame them. Number one.
Yeah.
Number two, that was really, really important. You asked me this before. I don't think it was until this experience that I felt like I had a mission, like I had a calling. I didn't really care about anything until this. Now I cared about staying out of prison. Mm-hmm. And I found a group of people that I like working with, mm-hmm. who other people didn't really ever want to talk to. So that was really the beginning for me when I got incredibly motivated and purposeful in what I was doing in my life.
Right. Okay. And then share with people how that ended up. You ended up getting your PhD, right?
Yeah. So I worked so hard in that master's program. I ended up winning scholarships I didn't even know existed, which felt really good because my parents were now off the hook for me financially. So I was now supporting myself. And all of my professors from Cal State Long Beach actually went to bat for me to try to get me back into UCLA, and it worked. UCLA was the number one psychology program in the country. So getting back in there was its own win. Went there, got my PhD at UCLA. But really from that advisor at Cal State Long Beach all the way to the end of my studies, I now took from all these different fields and I was looking at addiction. How does addiction start? What makes it better or worse? What works to relieve it? And then what we can talk about a little bit here, maybe, but the thing that really shifted my mind to a whole new way of looking at what I can do in this world was what keeps people from getting help was really the last kind of switch that flipped for me and made me go like, okay, I know where I'm going to put my focus for the next 10, 15 years.
Don't you wish everything was more rewarding? With Rakuten, almost everything is. You can earn cash back on those new shoes you've been wanting. You can save on the next trip you book. You can cash in on groceries. Just join. Shop your favorite brands and save. Sephora, Boots, Argus, Temu, Adidas, Trip.com. The list is long. Save online at over 550 stores. And when it's time to redeem those rewards, get your money exactly how you want it. Choose bank transfer or PayPal. So go ahead, take a trip, fill a cart, get a new outfit. Rakuten is a world of rewards. Join today for free. Go to rakuten.co.uk or get the app. That's Rakuten.
If you felt stuck trying to lose weight, you're not alone. Enter Weight Loss by Hers. It's designed to support you in reaching your goals. And Hers now offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first GLP-1 available in a pill, so there are no needles needed. Everything is 100% online through Hers. you'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door, no insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Weight loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget, if eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/women to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/women. forhers.com/women. Weight loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com.
All right, so I think everybody has a vision or a thought of what they think addiction is. Can you kind of succinctly tell me what you think it is?
Yeah, I look at addiction as any habit that you perform over a long period of time that keeps you from living a full, authentic life. What do I mean by full authentic? You're not showing up to your relationships well. You're not showing up to work, or you're giving up duties at work. Maybe you're not taking care of yourself, your health, right? It's keeping you back from showing up in the best way for yourself. Sometimes that's drugs. Sometimes that's alcohol. A lot of times it's behavior. This is becoming a bigger issue. We know food and sugar can actually be some of the hardest addictions in the world, right? Mm-hmm. Porn and technology addictions for men are a huge problem. There's a huge gap in terms of men who rely on porn to get what they need in relationships, so they never developed in the relationship themselves. Right. I believe that's one of the biggest causes of divorces, for instance. And then one thing that I work on with a lot of clients that people don't think about a lot is work addiction. Mm. You want to talk about a set of habits in life that hurt your health, well-being, and your relationships. Everybody listening to this right now knows at least one person in their life that when things go wrong, they go all in on work. Mm-hmm. But maybe they've already been divorced because of it. Maybe their health has already suffered because of it. And now you're talking about strokes. You're talking about diabetes. You're talking about heart attacks and other cardiovascular conditions, obesity, right?
Yeah.
Success can drive people away from things that take care of them otherwise. So all these things people don't consider addictions normally, I do.
Well, that's such an interesting one, work. Because there, of course, we know a ton of people who have, my parents were divorced because of that. You know, somebody was working all the time and the other one, you know, didn't get any attention. And then somebody cheated with their secretary. So, I mean, the standard all-American story of that kind of thing. But I feel like people don't see work as a major addiction because people just think, oh, if you're that good at your job, you have to, you know, if you have a powerful job, you should be working all the time. How do people know when that, you know, they're crossing that line?
Yeah, great question. So you use that for work addiction, and I totally understand it, right? We live, especially in the United States, but in Western society at large, we live in a place where external identifiers of success are the predominant measurements that we have. So, in business, we may call that KPIs, right? A key performance indicator. Well, a lot of people look at the amount of money you have. Let's say if you have a podcast, the number of downloads you have. If you have a business, kind of your revenue or your profits, right? Like we look at those as indicators of how well you're doing. Mm. The problem, and I talk about this in the book, is that is a very limited view of how you're doing, right? Hmm. I've worked with people where I'm literally sitting on their private jet as we're flying to business meetings, and they have to start drinking or using drugs early in the morning in order to deal with the stress and the level of, forget addiction, the level of depression that they experience on a daily basis. I would argue that having a private jet and being a multi-billionaire doesn't excuse the fact that you wake up in anxiety, stressed out, and depressed every day, right? It's like, if you could give up some of the money and have a lot more joy, that would go a long way towards creating a more balanced version of your satisfaction in life. Right. So it's not an objective measure. Each person needs to understand for themselves. I have some tools in the book actually that can help people understand where they fall on this. So that could be useful. But I look at life, it's called a quality of life assessment. Like overall, your life, how happy are you in your life in general?
All right. If you're looking to level up your fitness, health, and overall wellness, let me put you onto something. Amazfit. Their smartwatches go beyond basic fitness tracking to help you train smarter, not harder. Amazfit redefines smart fitness with AI-driven coaching, intelligent workout detection, and personalized recovery insights, all powered by the free Zepp app. You get in-depth analytics, downloadable maps, and even Zepp Flow AI voice control, making your fitness journey seamless and next level. And if you want the perfect mix of style and performance, check out the Amazfit Active 2 smartwatch. That's what I have. It features a sleek stainless steel design and advanced health tools like BioTracker, heart rate, and sleep monitoring. With 160 plus workout modes, up to 10 days of battery life, and offline maps with turn-by-turn directions, it's designed for people who want to stay on top of their game without sacrificing style. Since I got my watch, I've been wearing it nonstop. It tracks my sleep. I check every morning to see what my readiness score is. I'm able to tell how many hours I slept, how deeply I slept. I get a little buzz on my arm when I've been sitting for over an hour, and it tells me to get up and do some sort of a workout so I get my blood flowing. It has a super cool design that I don't mind wearing day or night. And here's the best part. You can get 10% off your Amazfit smartwatch. Just head to www.amazfit.com/understood. Pick your favorite model and your discount will be applied automatically at checkout. That's www.amazfit.com/understood. Trust me, once you try it, you'll wonder how you ever lived without it. Are you ready to make a statement, to challenge the status quo and embrace the fearless, wild, and unapology authentic version of you? I'm Rachel Yucatel, and I know firsthand what it's like to be misunderstood. That's why I'm all about Empower by Heidi, a brand that's not just about clothing, but about rebellion, self-expression, and breaking down barriers. They believe in authenticity, inclusivity, and body positivity, creating a safe haven for those who dare to defy expectations. Their apparel isn't labeled by gender. It's for everyone who wants to let their freak flag fly, challenge societal norms, and make a bold statement. And trust me when I say this, Empower by Heidi doesn't cut corners. Their high-quality, ethically made pieces feel as good as they look. I know because I've been living in their pink Empower sweatshirt. And let me tell you, it's the softest, most comfortable hoodie I've ever worn, with a message that makes me proud to wear it. Want to join the movement? Go to empowerbyheidi.com and use promo code MISUNDERSTOOD to get 10% off at checkout. That's Empower by Heidi.com to get 10% off with code MISUNDERSTOOD, spelled M-I-S-S, understood. Right. I love that. Okay. So I want to go back to something you were saying before about the definition of addiction. And we talked about this a little bit before. There are plenty of people listening to this, walking through life, that have addictions, but don't realize they do because they are functioning. They don't realize that it is covering anything up, whether it is, like we talked about, dipping, putting snooze in, or, you know, the sugar. I mean, listen, right before we started, I just got a handful of gummy bears, which I may be addicted to because I can't stop eating them when I walk in the kitchen. But, you know, I'm joking, but not really. I mean, we have addictions that maybe are not preventing us from interacting with family and getting through life, but it is maybe not healthy. So can you talk about those everyday things?
Yeah. So again, so that health piece would be the one piece that I would look at deeply, right? By the way, there are people who exercise to the point where they injure themselves regularly, right? That could be something you want to look at. Now, I know ultra marathon runners, they injure themselves regularly while they're running an ultra marathon, but in their regular practices and their trainings, if they want to have longevity, they make damn sure that they take care of themselves. So this is where things get nebulous. In the book, what I like to say is kind of this: I split the world in half. About half the world is struggling with addictions, while the other half of the world is watching those people who they care about try to have that struggle.
Right.
You talked about your dad. I just want to use that as an example because you half jokingly said it's a quintessential American story, right? It's like, but why, if you need to think about it for a second, the question is, at what point does a person decide that what they have going on at home is not worth putting the effort in and it's worthwhile focusing all their effort at work? The argument that I make in the book is it's not just about money. There are internal I'll call it feelings and beliefs that drive those decisions. And that's where I think it really, really matters. You talked about gummy bears, but I'll say it like this. I know people regularly who, in order to cope with negative emotional states, they eat.
Right.
Right.
Oh, yeah. Now, eating disorders are very prevalent and very hard to kick, by the way.
Very hard because, first of all, because food is everywhere, right? You can try to kick alcohol out of your house and that's an okay life. I haven't, to be fair, you know, 2022, I stopped meth use. It's 25. I don't even know that I've seen meth in 23 years because you kind of have to go seek that sort of stuff out. I don't have friends that use it, but for food, for sex, for work, those things are around you all the time. And so you have to learn to manage them. You can't eliminate them from your life, right? That's a big key indicator. So now it becomes more gray than black and white, which I think is the way it actually should be with everything.
Yeah.
And so you ask the question and I want to answer it really, really directly. If you pause right now and you think to yourself, here is a small number of habits that may fall into this category. Ask yourself the question, have I ever tried to stop those things or reduce my dependence on them? And I have a lot of tricks for that in the book. And have I found myself struggling? If the answer to that is yes, it's at least worth looking into. Because the point that I think you're making, and it's a point that is really, really prevalent in the addiction industry all the time, we don't give it enough thought, is you first have to recognize that it is a problem. You can't do anything about a problem that you haven't identified as such. So exercise could be a really, really important part of your life. But are you not connecting with your partner? Because exercise is more important than them? Are you giving up opportunities at work because you've made exercise more important? Are you injuring yourself regularly and then needing to deal with the injuries, right? If those things are happening and you've tried to ratchet it back and you haven't, my guess is exercise is not just a habit. It's a habit that is being driven by some internal need. It could be vanity, right? Like part of why I exercise is because I want to make sure I keep my weight in a certain category.
Right.
But it could be deeper than that. It could be trauma. It could be feelings of self-worth. And if that's what's happening, then the reason that the book is important, the reason these conversations are important, Rachel, exercise is not going to fix your self-esteem. That's internal work that you have to do on why your self-esteem is not how you want it, where you want it to be. And that's the point that I make in the book over and over and over. External things will never fix internal problems.
Right, right. So you're saying the first thing you need to do, which could be the hardest, is identifying that there could be some issue. And when you do identify that, start to look within and figure out what could be the cause, right?
Yeah. I have a two-step process to that identification. So in the book, I talk about something called the explore, accept, transform cycle, EAT for short. And I say it's the reason I called it EAT is, first of all, so everybody has an easy acronym to remember, but also just like you have to watch what you eat physically in order to take care of your body, you have to watch what you eat mentally in order to take care of your psychology. So explore is the part you were talking about. This is a really big key takeaway from all the work I do with my clients. When something goes wrong in life, most of us try to run away from it and avoid it. I actually recommend for people, if something went wrong, stop, pause and reflect, explore. Wait, what just happened? Why did this not go the way I wanted it to go? That could be over drinking and blacking out and doing something you don't want.
Right.
That could be having a fight with your partner where you're screaming at each other and you know, you're threatening leaving. So that negative outcome is a signal in your life screaming at you that something isn't working. If we don't take care of it, we try to sweep it under the rug or just pretend that it didn't happen, drink ourselves, go to work, numb it out. It's going to keep screaming and it's going to keep screaming more and more loudly because something is broken. Explore is about saying, okay, let me pay attention to the signal that is coming at me. You said that could be the hardest part. That's a really, really difficult part. You're completely right. I think the next stage is actually harder, and that is acceptance. So explore, accept, transform works like this. When we sit down and we try to think about what it is that we're unhappy with, a lot of us, myself included, when I do this in my life, we come up with answers that are not really comfortable. That's why we run so hard from recognizing them. Acceptance is about being able to sit with it and say, you know what? I understand this isn't great and it needs changing, but I need to give myself and the people in my life grace because I've been doing the best that I could to now, based on what I learned, what I know, the people that have been around me, the childhood I grew up in. I'm trying my best. So I have to accept it, come to terms with my current reality before we go to transform and work on actually changing it.
Right. You wrote a book called The Abstinence Myth, and it talks about a new approach for overcoming addictions, where you challenge traditional addiction recovery models. Can you talk a little bit about what was in that book?
Yeah. So we already talked a touch about it. It's not a repetition at all of Unhooked. But what I say in The Abstinence Myth is right now we measure success from addiction by did you use or did you not use? Those are the only two criteria that we care about. What I start introducing in The Abstinence Myth is it's a much, much more gray area than we've given it credit for being before. So mm-hmm. I introduce people to the idea that you have to measure quality of life in right. a whole slew of different arenas and an idea that I don't understand why. I mean, it's made it much, much more into the vernacular in the world over the last 10 to 15 years. Think the Sober Curious movement and some of these other movements that have happened since that book came out. If somebody drinks 5 drinks a day and they start paying attention to their drinking and then go down to 2, that improvement classically in the addiction world is still seen as failure.
Right.
And what I really tell people is, look, if you cut your drinking in half, you're doing better. Do you need to cut in half again? Maybe. Do you one day need to not drink at all? Maybe. But we can't leave behind the celebration of the wins we've had because we're not perfect. You talked about food addictions and eating disorders. The choice to chase perfectionism, if you will, is a huge part of eating disorders.
Right.
Work addictions, a huge part of that is perfectionism. And I think perfectionism is a problem in addiction. We don't want the solution to also espouse perfectionism because it can create more problems.
Right. So let's say that there are people listening right now and they're not in the category of like they're running from going to rehab. You know, like yep. they're working on something and they're just trying to, you know, get a little better. Can you yeah. give us some tools or tips on how you do that? Because I, what we've been talking about is like identify what the problem is. Some people are like, okay, yeah, maybe I know I'm in a bad marriage and I'm miserable, but like it's really hard to stop XYZ. Mm. So how do you stop those cravings? Those, you know, how do you stop?
So the biggest takeaway in the book is this. Don't try to stop yourself from a negative habit. Do everything you can to replace it with a better habit. Mm. That is something that has been completely lost in our industry for some reason. People will stop drinking and then go back to it and get upset with themselves instead of replacing it with something else. So that's a huge finding in the habit literature, less so in addiction because addiction is so black and white. But if you look at psychology, at neuroscience literature, replacing a habit is a lot easier and has substantially higher success rates than cutting a habit out.
Right. Okay. What about the people that are listening who are, it's not necessarily about them, but it's about somebody they know. How do you know when you're walking that fine line of enabling or, you know, putting the line in the sand and creating a boundary? I think people struggle with this all day long. They don't know how to talk to someone that they can see is really struggling.
Yeah. One point that I want to make when it comes to family members or loved ones talking to others is this. If you're struggling putting together boundaries, that's actually your work that needs to be done, right? A lot of us, based on how we grew up, whether we have avoidant attachment or anxious attachment, we feel like it's unsafe to put up boundaries for ourselves.
Right.
That is self-work. That's work you can't actually put on other people. You know, in the business world, there's a lot of push for radical candor and you know, crucial conversations. We need a lot of that in our own personal lives. A lot of us will not sit down and have the conversations that need to be had. Even in that piece you mentioned earlier, just a couple of minutes ago, if you know you're in a bad marriage, you've got to do something about it.
Right.
Yeah. Just kicking that can down the road a number of years is not going to help. So number one, the boundaries you mentioned, incredibly important, but that's work you have to do. There's actually, I talk about it in the book to some extent. There's a 5-step process. Define your own boundaries. Most of us don't even know what our boundaries are. And then communicate it to the other people. Just because you decided on boundaries doesn't mean anybody else knows what they are. So then you need to communicate them. And then you'll need to defend them. Because if you haven't had boundaries with people for a very, very long time, just communicating them is not going to necessarily make the other person trust you're serious.
Right.
It's in defending our boundaries a lot of people fail. Because people will test your boundaries and you need to say, hey, we already talked about this. I'm not doing this. I'm not giving you money, or I'm not allowing this, that, or the other thing to happen. So that is an incredibly important part of the equation. The second piece, and it actually kind of comes, Rachel, if you think about it, from how we talked about my experience to date. So research mets this out. The individual who is struggling needs to own their path out of it. Nobody else can do the work for them. And if you are doing the work for them right now, you're actually, this is where enabling comes in, right? Because you're actually hamstringing them in a way. It's like taking somebody's crutches away with when their leg's broken and expecting them to be able to walk on their own. They're going to have to do it very, very gradually and slowly. The crutches are there for a reason. What I found with a lot of loved ones, they need to bring in professional support because they're not good at serving as the crutches for somebody they really, really love. They end up lifting them. They end up almost kind of like picking them up by themselves and taking them to the place instead of laying them walk with crutches or a cane.
Right. And I've been involved in a few interventions, which are really hard to be part of, because when you're giving that boundary of like, unless you go somewhere, we're not going to be in your life anymore. And that's a really hard place to be. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. But what I've learned just in my 50 years on this earth and being around all sorts of these kind of people, including myself in different situations, until you're ready to make that decision, no one can love you enough. No one can tell you the words enough. You have to make those decisions, because otherwise, I mean, it just will never happen. It'll never be 100% of this person taking the steps to get clean or to be better or to be more honest. It just won't happen unless they want to do it.
I absolutely agree. And in effect, that's the problem with enabling. What enabling does for somebody is it pushes real life consequences down the road. You can think about this for kids at a very young age. I've got three kids, right? If every time your kid doesn't want to go to school, you call them in sick to school, you're enabling their lack of motivation for attending school, right? Because what you're saying is, well, go to school, don't go to school, I'll cover for you. You're saving them from consequences. What ends up happening at some point, life catches up. And at some point, your kids are too old. You can't protect them from consequences anymore. And they're going to hit the ground on their own. And so boundaries are actually a healthy thing, right? Yeah. What I tell all my clients is, whether you know it or not, you have red flags. You have red lines that nobody can cross. If they cross them, you will cut them out by definition.
Yeah.
By not having boundaries, what you're essentially telling people is, until you cross my red line, I won't even warn you that you're crossing boundaries. And then again, this is where divorces happen. This is where families break up. This is where people lose jobs, all those other pieces of the puzzle. Boundaries are a healthy part of functioning. They're not a problem.
Right. I want to ask you a question, because you talked about kids for a second. How old are your kids?
I got a 14, a 12, and a 6-year-old.
Okay. So I have a 12-year-old. Kids, and now your 14-year-old is probably getting into it with peer pressure and, you know, the drug conversation and all this kind of thing. You hear a lot of parents and kids, I guess, as they get into their 20s, talking about how it was okay to try things and just get drunk all the time or do things in excess when it comes to these substances, because they think that's part of their youth. What do you think the difference is? I mean, we all know what the difference is, but what would you say about the difference of people, you know, falling into peer pressure and just getting crazy because they're in their teens and their early 20s and they just want to get wrecked all the time because that's what you do on Friday and Saturday nights, where the difference is between an addict and stopping that early? Like, how do we talk to our kids about this so that, because if they're like, well, I'm not an addict, but, you know, we all were just having fun and mom, that's what we do. You know what I'm saying?
I do. I absolutely do. So I think there are a couple of things that we need to weigh in here. We typically think of addiction as being in the person. And I think that's a mistake. And there are a couple of reasons, right? So when I got my PhD, behavioral neuroscience was my area of specialty, but that included genetics and a lot of other things like that. So for a long time, Rachel, I bought hook, line, and sinker the idea that the person has a condition. Now I think that's BS. And there's a reason. It's not that there isn't something about the people who struggle, but that there's something massive also about the environment that they're in and the experience they had earlier. So it's this nexus of psychology, environment, and biology. Mm-hmm. I also insert spirituality to some extent into that mixture, but I can explain how that comes in. Now, your biology has to interact with the people and the physical space that you're in, and then with your experience. What do I mean by this? Take somebody who has a genetic predisposition to risk-taking and impulsivity. Now put them in an environment with a bunch of kids that are trying out new drugs all the day and ditching school. Now put them in a place where their experience early on in life included some trauma and some other issues that make them more vulnerable, or like my social anxiety when I was younger, right? Make you vulnerable. You put those three together and you've got a recipe for disaster. But you can have somebody who's biologically predisposed and put them in a healthy environment, and they may never end up with a drug or alcohol addiction. Right. So for kids, we know this, by the way, this is important for all of us parents, Rachel, to remember. I was actually just talking to my wife about this yesterday. It is incredibly important that you monitor who your kids' friends are, because you completely underestimate the impact of the environment. We do to this day. I can take somebody who's really struggling with addiction, put them in a really healthy environment. A year, year and a half, 2 years later, they're going to be different. Are they going to be fixed or cured? I don't know. That also depends on the work that you do with them, but they're going to be an entirely different person. The problem with children is they're still developing who they are. So you put them into a dangerous, I'll call it dirty, but I don't really mean dirty, but a dangerous environment where they're exposed to a ton of risk. If they start absorbing some of that risk, that now becomes part of the profile they walk into adulthood with. Nice. So as children, as parents, one of our biggest responsibilities is actually to help our kids live in relatively healthy environments.
Right. I want to look ahead for a second. What changes would you like to see in how mental health and addiction treatment are addressed globally? Now, you know, what do you see in the future?
Love it. Number one, and this is already happening to some extent, but I think recognizing the impact of underlying deeper source conditions that are driving symptoms is huge. Again, I can talk about a whole slew of these in addiction. I just mentioned it, right? If you're drinking because you're socially anxious and you can't be around other people, everybody tries to fix your drinking. I want to fix your social anxiety, because if I fix your social anxiety, you don't need it as much. But this exists for depression. It exists for anxiety. It obviously exists for trauma. And as a field, we are moving to becoming much, much more trauma-informed. I think the biggest change, and I talk about this pretty early in the book, Rachel, for mental health, I think we need to move away from this idea where we apply a label to people. So we'll say, you know, this person has depression, and we need to create a lot more nuance in our mental health labels, because depression can happen for a lot of different reasons. And we keep focusing on the symptoms. And we know that's a problem with our healthcare system in general, right? Mm-hmm. We treat obesity with drugs that make you less obese. We don't deal with why did people start overeating in the first place. Sure. So I think that's a lot of what we need to start looking at.
Right. We've talked a lot about the book. Unhooked, Free Yourself from Addiction Forever. It came out January 7th. Tell people a little bit about it, what they can expect from it, and where they can get it.
Yeah, thank you. The first few chapters of Unhooked are kind of setting you to understand the addiction problem totally differently. The rest of the book is almost like a choose your own adventure. Mm-hmm. What do I mean by that? I present you with a model of how, but we talked about looking back at your negative experiences and understanding where they came from. I give you a lot of tools to understand that. Mm-hmm. And then I help you with how do you come to acceptance, and then what can you transform? By the way, ironically, I'll just talk about where we are right now. People feel like they're going to struggle more with the transform side. Like you said, it's hard to change habits. Mm-hmm. Here's what I've found. I've worked with thousands of people now. Here's what I found. When you really understand what the underlying problem is, like let's say my social anxiety, or another woman I talk about in the book, it had to do with these embarrassing experiences that she had early on in school, like elementary and junior high. When you understand those issues, now that's something you really want to solve. You don't want to solve the drug use, because that's what's making you feel better, but you want to solve the underlying issues. Number one, that becomes important. Number two, then podcasts like this, Rachel, Andrew Huberman's podcast, Mel Robbins, the books, the shows, now they become teaching tools. They become positive experiences you want to start absorbing. Yeah. But I'll give the example you gave before. If a woman is really struggling in her relationship and knows she's in a bad marriage, and so she starts drinking at noon, I've dealt with many, many experiences like this, just starts drinking at noon to deal with it and is drunk by the end of dinner, dealing with drinking feels scary, because now you're just left with a bad marriage. But if you start reading books, checking out podcasts, getting fulfilled in getting interesting information about how to fix your marriage, you can go to town on that because that is something you really, really want to fix. So what I found is when people work through the system that I talk about in Unhooked, they really want the change, and we don't deal with the same sort of issues that we deal with in traditional recovery, which is somebody's trying to break their habit and keep having lack of success and they feel badly about it.
Right. And one other thing I want to say about that is I think that so many people think that there has to be some sort of trauma in your past, or you have to be in a bad marriage, or all these things that we've been talking about to make you use. I think that I've met personally a lot of people who just have not found their purpose. And especially after COVID and like not figuring out their life, they're bored and they don't know what the hell to do. And they are, that's why they start drinking at 12. I mean, I would, and I've been in that situation where I don't know where my purpose is and I felt lost. And, you know, it was really hard to find. And to me, I think that's something that can cause a lot of people to veer off. And so the underlying thing would be for people to really start paying attention to who they are and what they want to do and finding their purpose. Because I have found that my happiness really revolves around that.
Amen to everything you just said. And I'll just say it like this. So I talked about the fourth factor. So there's biology, experience, environment, spirituality. I look at purpose as your connection to your spirituality. And I think I almost felt that as you were talking about yours, Rachel. When you find your purpose, I found it with that advisor by mistake, right? Like I just ran into it by mistake in graduate school. But the moment you find that, all the things that seem to bother you before in life, they just kind of become part of the regular everyday experience you have in order to serve your purpose. It doesn't matter all that much. So there's actually literally a section in the book and then a set of exercises using something called Ikigai, which I don't know if you know what that is, but that's like the Japanese word for purpose, essentially. And so I help people understand it. And I literally have a line that you'd love in the book, Rachel, which says, if you don't know what your purpose is, make it your purpose to find your purpose.
I love it.
Because the moment you land on that, everything in life changes.
I agree. All right. Well, this has been amazing. Please tell people where they can find you and reach you if they want more information.
Yeah, please. So social media handles on all channels is at Dr. Adi Jaffe, as it shows right there. I've got a website called Read Unhooked, if you just want to go directly for the book. If you want to learn more generally about what I do, adijaffe.com is its own website. And I'd love to connect with anybody.
Awesome. Dr. Jaffe, I really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me, Rachel.
Thank you so much for listening to Misunderstood. I'm your host, Rachel Yucatel. Please be sure to subscribe to the show and give us a 5-star rating and review. You can support the show by joining our Patreon at patreon.com/misunderstood with Rachel Yucatel. Do you have ideas for the show or want to reach out? Email us at info@misunderstoodpodcast@gmail.com. That's spelled MISS understood. Thank you so much, and I'll see you next time.